I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Pursued by a Bear podcast. I'm Nicole Saratori, Broadway editor of Exeunt NYC. Today we are hosting a book club to talk about the new book released in February called The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America by Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce, an oral history of the play. This month, Angels in America returns to the Broadway stage on the 25th anniversary of the original Broadway production. The production from the National Theater has transferred with much of the same cast, including Andrew Garfield, James McArdle, Nathan Lane, and Denise Goff, and a few notable newcomers, including Lee Pace and Beth Malone. I sat down with a couple fellow Exeunt critics to talk about our relationship to Angels in America and our experience with reading this new book. Enjoy. But yeah, I like the soft opening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is that Hedwig line?
Good morning.
Oh yeah,
I like a warm hand.
Warm hand on my opening. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a good spiritual guide for today's journey. So why don't we introduce ourselves?
I'm Lane Williamson. I'm a critic for Exeunt, and I love Angels in America, as we all do.
Yeah, I'm Alex Berish. I am also a critic for Exeunt, among other places. I write for Slate as well, and I too am a big fan of Angels in America.
Conveniently, we've brought together some fans. I probably should have brought a hater. I don't know that I know any, but...
Just Michael Riedel is the only one.
That's true. And I'm Nicole Saratori. I'm the Broadway editor for Exeunt NYC. And we're here today to talk about both Angels in America and the book The World Only Spins Forward. This was sort of Alex's idea when I was tweeting about, like, I wish I had a book club to talk about this. And then Alex was like, oh, what about a podcast? Oh, right. That is an actual technological invention. We have it available to us. So we have a couple ways to sort of approach it. And I think the nicest way to start would be to talk about our first Angels in America, our first experience of the play in production of some form. So because I am 108 years old, I saw Angels in America on Broadway in 1993. It was kind of an interesting moment for the play and for me and for what was sort of going on at the time. But I was coming to NYU as a freshman, and NYU was in Angels fever because they had been, as mentioned in this book, there was a student production of Perestroika in the grad acting department. And Tony was on campus for that. And I think he might have even been teaching some classes. I'm not quite sure. But everybody had assigned the reading for the summer. Like, we were all encouraged, not assigned, to read Millennium that summer. And then the university pretty much just gave us all tickets to go see it. And that wasn't just for, I was at the Tisch School of the Arts, but my friend who was at the College of Arts and Science also was able to do this. So we all were kind of wrapped up in the national conversation about Angels, but on campus as well. And I was 17, and I just moved to the city, and this was the first play I saw on Broadway. I was like, oh, so all plays are like this. No, Broadway does not look like this and has not looked like this since.
Has that created unrealistic expectations?
For my entire life. Yeah. I feel like this is the origin story of my criticism, if you ever wanted to understand where I'm coming from. So I think I obviously will always have a super warm spot in my heart for that original production, like so much so that I avoided the HBO miniseries because I just couldn't do it. I was like, no, no one will ever do justice to this play as was done in my heart in 1993 by Joe Mantello and David Marshall Grant and Marcia Gay Harden. So I think that's my first Angels that sort of meant the world to me. It's funny because I always look at the play as Lewis's play, because I saw that production, and then I've seen other productions, I was like, oh, no, it is Pryor's play. But it's hard with Joe Mantello. I mean, you guys.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's a great point, because I also look at the play as Lewis's play, and I didn't see Joe Mantello. But I think that just comes from my identification with Lewis even from the first time I read the play. So this leads into my first Angels. In 1993, I was 4, so and I lived in West Virginia. So in West Virginia, 4-year-olds were not really up on Angels in America. But
she's the pity.
But when the miniseries was announced, I was a freshman in high school, and I read the play first, and then I remember being in driving school because I'm from California. I walked on our lunch break to the Costco nearby and bought the DVDs of the miniseries and watched it. I didn't watch it as it aired. I watched it on those DVDs from Costco and became entirely obsessed with this. And I remember sitting in like PE class in high school on like a rainy day or something. And I was reading it, and then people would come over to me and they'd be like, "What are you reading?" And I'd be like, "Oh my God." And I would read scenes aloud to them from the book, which, you know, one of my favorite scenes to read was the, fuck me, hurt me, make me bleed park scene.
You were popular in high school.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be like, and then I would explain the doubling of Pryor to people. But my first live Angels did not come until I moved to New York and saw the Next Wave, the BAM Next Wave transfer of Ivo Van Hove's Angels in America, which, you know, as you know if you saw it, is abridged. They do all of Millennium Approaches with zero intermissions. And then there's a break, or I think there's one, was there one intermission?
I don't even remember, but yeah, it feels like, yeah. It's sort of, he's like, what, why would you stop? Just keep going.
Right. And then the play just like abruptly ends when, Lewis comes back to Pryor with the bruises. Then that's the last scene of Ivo's Angels. Well, there's no Night Flight to San Francisco. There's no, You Are Fabulous Creatures. None of that happens. It just ends. And I was furious. And I was like, this is not. And at that point, the only Van Hove thing I'd seen was scenes from a Marriage at New York Theater Workshop, which I loved and was obsessed with. And so then this, I was like, what is he doing? How is this acceptable? Why does Tony Kushner say this is his favorite production of Angels in America? And over, like, since then, I have come to think back on it, and I have a fondness for it. And I think that there are definitely images that stick out to me from that. So that was my first live. Alex?
Yeah, I mean, reading about that production in this book, The World Only Spins Forward, was really interesting because he was saying that Pryor's final speech was very American, so they cut it. And I was like, what are you doing? That's like the best part of this play. Yeah. But my first experience with the play, because I was born in 1996.
Oh my and gosh, now I feel old.
Thank God somebody else can feel old in this.
I'm sorry. I mean, it was to my disadvantage because I missed all of these opportunities to see this play live. So
I wasn't even a like fertilized egg yet. And I have FOMO.
Like, genuinely. I mean, I think you also went to the event where in Brooklyn where they did a staged reading and they brought some of the members of the original cast. And Laura Miller, who was moderating that conversation, was talking about having seen it in San Francisco. And I was like, I hate you so much. This sounds incredible. And, you know, she was making reference to specific staging decisions from all those years ago. And I was like, why is there no record of this? I mean, now there kind of is, which is great. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I first came to it through the HBO miniseries because that was really the only option available to me. And I came to it with the idea that that I would be connecting with the history of my community as a young gay man through this kind of great defining work of literature that was very seminal. And I didn't really know that it was supposed to be funny. And I mean, I was deeply moved by it, and I did laugh at it at points, but I think it's true that the HBO adaptation is a little bit more self-serious and a little bit more about the tragedy. And I'm not sure that that production showed me just how human and honest and messy it could be. And I think I was kind of alienated from Perestroika because of that, because it felt so self-serious. And the way that the angel played and the principalities played, it felt like this production thought it had all the answers in a way that I was like, no, it doesn't. But I think a lot of that is just about being there with an audience and having other people reacting to it with you. Like, my first experience was just watching it on my laptop with my boyfriend. And I still haven't seen it live in its entirety. I saw Millennium Approaches at the National and really enjoyed that. But I have read and devoured the script itself, and I'm looking forward to seeing the other half on Broadway. So...
And that's sort of what prompted a little bit of this conversation, as well as the publication of the book, is that, I mean, it's returning to Broadway, and I am making room in my heart for another production. I mean, I also saw the Evo production. I saw the, and I will not speak of it again, the off-Broadway, and I'm going to put this in quotes, production of Angels in America, which I was really appreciative of how little it was in the book. But let's turn then now to talk about the book a little bit, because I think, as you've sort of mentioned, it does cover so many of these iconic productions, as well as a little bit of the cultural history taking place at the time. I guess I sort of thought it was going to be, you know, it certainly is focused on the development of the play and how the play even came to exist in its sort of messy birth and growth. But let's talk about our favorite part of this book. So this book was published in February, and I know the minute I started reading it, it was so hard to put down. I wanted to just keep, because it's an oral history, it's all of these voices and all these voices of people who are fascinating, creators, artists, journalists, and activists and academics sort of talking about this work and its sort of place in American history, really. So let's talk about our favorite part of the book. Lane, why don't you start?
I grew up going to the Mark Taper Forum, starting on field trips in high school, before I left California, I would go there all the time to see plays. I think it's an incredible theater. Yeah, have you been there, Mark Taper Forum?
No, I actually haven't.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thrust space that everything you see there from any seat feels like it's handing itself to you. It feels, I've seen a huge, not huge, but like sizable musicals there, and I've seen tiny plays there. And everything that I've seen is so immediate. And so after I became obsessed with this play, I would just sit in the Mark Taper Forum, no matter what I was seeing, and think about Angels in America. And they have the regional theater Tony. They have a regional Tony, but then they also have an Angels in America Tony engraved in the basement, and which is where the restrooms are. And
I mean, the place of honor.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was
everybody will see it if it's near the bathroom.
about 10 years ago it was renovated, so it's very nice down there now. Please go see the restrooms at the Mark Taper Forum. So when I would go to the bathroom, I would walk by this Tony, and it would just smack me in the face, you know, how much I was experiencing by being in this space where this thing was not created, but grown. My love for Joe Mantello as a director and an actor was being built at that time too. And so I just felt every time I would go to the Mark Taper Forum about how I would feel so this overwhelming sense of passion for this play. And so my favorite parts of the book were about the Taper and the Taper 2 productions of Angels and what that was like being there. And I did not know that K. Todd Freeman was Belize, yeah. Which was so exciting because anyone who's familiar with me at all knows that I love Airline Highway by Lisa D'Amour, which starred K. Todd Freeman.
And directed by Joe Mantello.
And directed by...
his old buddy from Angels in America.
Yeah. I mean, amazing.
I know. It is nice to see the voice... the so many people who had a role in the development of this play come out in this book. And again, many, many people that I didn't know had an involvement or participated in some aspect of its growth as it moved along. How about you, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, it would have to be the Eureka production and kind of the development, because the work leading up to the kind of birth of Angels in America is something that I didn't know a lot about going in. And I really loved hearing about the play's origins and the people who influenced it as well, like and the way that the actors matched up with their characters, and especially the dialogue between Kushner and Kimberly Flynn, who was a close friend of his and sort of an intellectual sparring partner in a way. Hearing about the way that her car accident and sort of the subsequent issues that she had to deal with respect to her health and her relationship with Kushner, and how all of that informed the character of Pryor and the sort of development of the play as a whole, was really moving and really interesting as well. And I think just sort of understanding the dynamics that informed the play and taking us back to this point before it was kind of an all-consuming phenomenon and baptized as a great work of American literature has a lot of value, because I've never known it as anything other than that. I wasn't there at the inception to sort of appreciate the growing phenomenon. And also, the insight into the way that the play was promoted is occasionally kind of hilarious. Like, before it was able to speak for itself as this great work, like, there's a flyer on page 51 for the Eureka production, and the caption is, "Our systems are breaking down. AIDS, the ozone, the government, and God has disappeared." And I just love that as this, like, campy, you know, here's this really high stakes story. And it's all of those themes do get dealt with in Angels in America in a very beautiful and effective way. But that's not really what I think about necessarily when I think about the play. And I just find it funny the way that they had to talk about it before it could stand up on its own terms.
I can sort of imagine that in the terrible movie trailer voice. In the world, God has walked away.
I love that, like, that, like, late 80s, early 90s obsession with the ozone layer that then made it onto that flyer, too. As if, like, that display is about the, you know, using aerosol cans.
Hairspray has taken us down, and now we're here. Well, I mean, again, I think it does come from our sort of first relationship sometimes with the play, but my bias in reading the book was certainly to sort of gobble up the whole section on the original Broadway production, the characters, the actors that I had seen on stage, and all of the sort of backstage machinations that were happening that obviously were not available to me to know about. So this whole segment with Marcia Gay Harden and the wig.
Yeah.
Apparently she was obsessed with wearing a terrible wig to play Harper. And George C. Wolfe, like, the exchange in the book is, and I will quote, "I had a wig," to which George C. Wolfe says, "Oh God, the wig." And it just goes from there. There's, like, actual, like, physical chaos that happens afterwards. So I really appreciated, like, some of those little, like, backstage nuggets that, I definitely didn't know about at the time. But also, I think there's so much from David Marshall Grant in there about his own sort of self-realization about his life in the closet and his connection to the character of Joe, who he played at the time, and how when he started the production, he was still in the closet professionally. And then sort of by the end of the Broadway production, he was out. But how much of that experience, like his actualization of, his connection to Joe, his understanding of how a man could marry a woman and have this public life that was so separate from his private life and his own mind. And I think he has this really lovely quote about leaving acting ultimately, because after this he became a playwright and a producer and a showrunner and, you know, had quite a long career in entertainment. So David Marshall Grant talks about leaving acting, and he has this really powerful quote about the experience, saying, "Being an actor was so filled with the shame of being gay and my whole journey refusing to be who I was that it all got mixed up with acting, and I wanted to be myself." Just such a moving sort of revelations from him in this book were so unexpected for me. And I really love that they made backstage movies of Joe Mantello, David Marshall Grant, and Marsha Gay Harden in the character of Martin, who's the sort of weird like Justice Department guy in the play that she plays at some point. And that Martin was deeply in love with David Marshall Grant. Just like the sort of ridiculous, goofy backstage antics of these people who I've held in such high esteem for so long, showing themselves to be totally human and adorable. Yeah.
I want to see those documentaries so badly.
Oh my God, I know. Like, where's the footage, you guys?
The people demand.
Yeah. But I thought it did do a great job of kind of unpacking the reverence that people now have for Angels in America and showing just the utter chaos that sort of went into the whole production every step of the way and every single production because he kept rewriting it.
And it's hard. There are 9,000 anecdotes in the book about trying to fly the angel and angels getting injured and the hilarity of an angel upside down on stage in their entrance and like all of the mistakes. And it is sort of that human fallibility quotient that's so apparent in this book for a show that has been held in such high esteem, but that it is really, really difficult to do.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting that I'm not going to speak for everyone, but I think that a lot of people, me as well, forget that this is just a play, you know? It's just like a play that people were doing. The reverence that I have for it and that a lot of people have for it came from just actors doing a play at the Walter Kerr, you know? It's kind of crazy to think about that now it's so golden, now it's so, you know, it's such a monument now.
Well, let's talk about also what sort of surprised us in this book, because I think that is one of the fun elements of being able to pick up this oral history now in this moment, and break down some of that reverence and our experience of the play. Does anyone have a sort of favorite moment or things that surprised them rather?
Yeah, I was really surprised by sort of how close we came to not having key characters and key moments. Like the existence of Harper and Hannah and to a lesser extent the Angel is predicated on the fact that the Eureka Company had a certain number of women and he needed to write parts for a certain number of female characters. And he complained about it. He was like, what are these women doing in this play about gay men? And, you know, they are such an instrumental part of it now that the idea that they almost weren't there, that they were sort of a fluke of casting is wild. And then also certain exchanges sort of only happened because he was in conversation with the actors themselves as the play was being developed. Like there's a moment where he talks about, or Tony had a conversation with Joseph Meidel, who played Belize in London in the 1993 production. It's on page 298 in the book. And Meidel says, I remember very distinctly that just as we got to part two, I had a conversation with him about Belize, saying, why is it that a black character is always an attendant to a white character? Why don't we know anything about Belize other than his relationship with Pryor? Does he have a life outside of being a nurse? And then he wrote this incredible scene between Lewis and Belize. And that's the moment in which Belize sort of sets the record straight and says, actually, my life doesn't revolve around Pryor and I have my own love life and my own stuff going on. And just the fact that we almost didn't have that quite important moment where he establishes his autonomy in that way was really surprising and interesting to me. And I just thought it was really valuable to see the way that these conversations, the way that Tony's own experiences and the way that the actor's experiences and his openness to them sort of led to these scenes that I would now think of as being really vital to the work.
I mean, obviously I was aware of Oscar Eustace's association with the play, but I didn't know about the whole contentious fight, really, that they had, and the two directors, and you know, Tony essentially moving the play away from Oscar. I saw them one time sitting together in the library at the Public, and it blew my mind. And just to see the two of them sitting talking together, and so then when I read that part of the book, I was like, wow, this seems like it was very difficult for both of them, but somehow they are still friends.
I know, I've definitely ended friendships over so much less.
Oh, yeah, me too. Every day.
And to have been sort of like you know, sort of cut out of this incredible play, this, you know, monumental American play, right. Like, yeah, sort of marginalized in the experience for reasons.
Yeah. I mean, not that Oscar Eustace has not
he's done okay for himself afterwards. I was really surprised by how many straight people played these characters over time. I mean, again, my bias with the New York production in the 90s, you know, I saw gay actors playing gay characters, and so hadn't really considered how special and unique that was at that moment. And so many actors, particularly in the book, sort of talking about their own internalized homophobia and how you know, being in these roles and these characters helping them move through that. And I think, I mean, for me, certainly seeing the play at the time, at a time where, you know, my coming from, you know, small town America, spent a lot of time within the bubble of homophobia wherever I was, coming to New York and starting to break that down as a teen and meeting gay people and spending time in New York. I mean, it just, the play unto itself was part of that process for me. And there were certainly anecdotes within the book about people seeing the humanity of gay people through this play. But I guess I was really just sort of surprised once you really start to look at the casting list over time and who was playing some of these roles. And certainly it's come back now for me with Andrew Garfield playing Pryor, sort of putting aside some of his awkward public comments on the subject. But you know, watching a straight man play a drag queen and trying to do that without falling into stereotype or parody. I mean, as the audience sitting there knowing Andrew Garfield, you know, to be this straight man playing this very, performative feminine character, was a really striking experience and made me really think about how remarkable it was Tony Kushner chose to put the hero's journey in the hands of this feminine, performative, outest of out gay men. And that's the hero. And he is the strongest person in the story. Which again, when I spent all these years thinking, oh, it's Lewis's story. like, no, I realize it's Pryor's journey. But seeing, you know, watching Andrew Garfield do that really sort of broke that open for me a little bit more.
I love that photo on page 15 of Tony and Steven Spinella at Gay Pride before all of this happened. Yeah. And they both have these huge heads of curly hair. It's just, it's so beautiful.
I was also surprised by, and Alex is somebody who, you've lived in the UK.
Yeah.
but I didn't know about Section 28 and the history of that in the UK. And so the book talks a little bit about this from 1988 to 2003, the law barred the promotion of homosexuality. So for the London productions of Angels in America that took place in the 90s, they were not legally able to stage the gay sex in the play, and that, I mean, just simply the act of doing this play was sort of walking a very fine line about on this issue of the promotion of homosexuality. And I, you know, not being aware of that law's existence, it really sort of struck me what an incredible chilling effect that must have had on people's lives, on representation, on, you know, in a way to keep people down further and longer and well into the 2000s.
Yeah, and I mean, we see that in America as well, because earlier in the book it talks about how the New York Times couldn't write the word gay and put that in print. And just the idea of this, I mean, that was more self-censorship, I guess, but the way that these things just were not talked about, and then suddenly you have this national tour of a play that is very frankly and unapologetically about this community and these issues, that must have just been monumental.
And I would also say there were two sort of really brilliant observations in this book that I wanted to point out. And I think maybe, Lane, you maybe tweeted about one of these as well. But
I'm sure.
Michael Crass, the costume designer of the national tour, talks about his sort of struggles to sort out all the costuming issues in the play. But he said, you know, there are so many quick changes and wig changes and female to male changes. And why is it so complicated? Could the doubling be different? But by way of assignment of the actor to role, it's all purposeful because there's no straight male delivering authority. It is, in fact, very conscious. And I think even the rabbi, even the doctor, even Martin, even the old Bolshevik, they're played by women, and it's deeply subversive. And as obvious as that is to me now, as he says it, I never thought about that before.
Yeah, no, it's so fascinating because you see so many pieces of gay white male art that are misogynist, that in their focus on gay men, they neglect women or they diminish women or they make women the sidekick or, you know, she's sassy or whatever. But this play does not do that. Harper is treated in this play like she's one of the, her strength is as dominant as Roy's, as Pryor's, more so than Joe, which I think is a true feat that he was able to do that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, I've always seen her journey in parallel to Pryor's, particularly as it was played in the original Broadway cast. I mean, they both had a very similar energy, Marcia Gay Harden and Steve Spinella, in their sort of hyper characters and their presence, their presence on stage and sort of joy that they took from each other and discoveries they made of each other. And that, you know, she is seeking out her truth. She is sorting that out and will not, you know, leave this play until she knows where she stands, and then will, you know, build her new life in whatever direction she's headed. West, apparently. And, you know, Joe isn't there yet. He is so far from making it to that, you know, he is so embryonic in his journey. And it's funny because I feel like there are conversations about, like, characters who feel hated in the play and the actors who played them. Joe Mantello talks about people sort of lobbing a lot of hatred toward Lewis and a lot of animosity toward Joe. And, I mean, you know, I can imagine specifically in the 90s where you have an audience full of people who have been caring for their loved ones who are sick, who are dying of AIDS, people who have lost their loved ones in that way, to watch a character walk away from his partner in the midst of that had to have been, you know, I can't even imagine what that experience would have been like. So I understand intellectually where that comes from. But as the sort of naive 17-year-old who looked at Lewis as a character of like, oh my God, I am that flawed, fucked up mess. And I don't know what my choices would have been. And I know that that choice, when I read it, when I saw it at the time, was just sort of like, it was baffling. It was like, oh, I've never seen anyone do that in their life. You know, anyone who's ever been in my family who was sick, people would care for. But, you know, like it never crossed my mind that there was a choice there. But at the same time, there was something incredibly liberating about the honesty of that and the his struggle with it. And I mean, he doesn't do it easily, and he spends the entire play twisted in knots over that decision. But it does sort of lead me to the other quote that really struck me in the book, that, again, sort of feels obvious now in retrospect. But David Cromer, the director, they talk about his production in Chicago in the book as well. But he says...
In which he also played Lewis. He directed it and played Lewis.
Oh, my God, I didn't realize that. I think I missed that.
Yeah, they talk about that in the... Yeah, he talks about that.
Oh, my God, that's fascinating. But he says, we all want to believe that we are Harper and Pryor, these magical wounded heroes. Most people are Joe and Lewis. We're all Joe and Lewis. We're weak and liars, and I love those characters for that. And that, I mean, it's always been my perspective, and I've never hated Lewis or Joe, and now only, you know, as an older person, at 108 years old, I really understand that flawed fuck-upness of both of them, and that journey and process that they are both going through in very different ways, and the way in which it sort of comes out. So even at the end, I do feel sad for Joe. Like, I have sympathy for... You know, and that is sort of remarkable in the history of the world, you know, like a Reaganite Republican that I have sympathy for, who, you know, worked on that law in that case and did the terrible things he did in that case. But still, because he's so lost, and I, you know, maybe I have more hope for him that he will find his way, because I want to believe that for all of us.
Yeah, when I saw it last week, I don't want to talk too much about the current production because, you know, it hasn't opened and blah, blah, blah. So, something unlocked for me about Joe, because at the end of the Bolshevik speech at the beginning of Perestroika, Bolshevik, played by Hannah, says, if the snake sheds his skin before a new skin is ready, naked he will be in the world, prey to the forces of chaos. And then there's that scene at the towards the end of Perestroika where Joe sheds his skin. And I had never, like, I've read this play so many times, and I had never picked up on that, that since Joe shed his skin, he's naked to the forces of chaos. And it unlocked a new sense of sympathy for Joe with me.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually, because I hadn't made that connection either. I thought it was really interesting in the book just hearing different people talk about trying to reckon with Joe as a character and the fact that he doesn't really get that closure except in the miniseries when there's an additional scene where he's talking to his mother, or it's shown that she's living with him. And just, you know, Kushner apparently almost wrote another play just about Joe and sort of what happens to him afterwards. And I find it really interesting the way that people are trying to grapple with this and that he does inspire such an array of responses, because on the one hand, like, he is the kind of character that it's pretty easy to hate. He is this Reaganite Republican, and he's, you know, allowed Harper to believe that she is delusional rather than telling this truth about himself, although of course that is very difficult in itself. And he is this very complicated character, and the text doesn't quite know what to do with him, and different productions have taken different approaches to that in a way that it was useful to see them all lined up together and compare and sort of draw your own conclusions about him.
Nicole, when you saw the, I know you don't want to talk about it, but when you saw the Michael Greif production at Signature, I know that he substantially rewrote Joe for that production. Was it noticeable to you?
Well, for the record, I only saw part one of the Off-Broadway. I had a ticket to part two, and I didn't go. To give you any indication of how well Millennium Approaches went in that production for me. So I don't have any recall of that. My only recollection is just pure fury at that production. blinding hatred. And it's so terrible because there are so many actors in that production who are wonderful and have done wonderful work that I've really enjoyed. But I really can't lay the blame on them, but that production made this play feel trite, which I didn't think was possible.
That's crazy. He has made rewrites even since the National Theater production last year that concern Joe that are very noticeable in Perestroika. Especially in that shedding the skin scene. And maybe that's why I made that connection. No, it's not, because I made that connection before that scene happened. So, but there is a huge thing that he has changed after. Should I just say what it is?
I don't know, because I haven't seen it yet. So I'm going to be mad if you spoil something for me. Or will it enrich my experience if I know it now? Think long and hard on that, Lane.
We can take a minute and kind of.
No, it's not like a spoiler. So
okay, go ahead.
After Joe strips himself naked and says, "You know, I'll do whatever you want," essentially, and Lewis leaves. Before, Joe only said, "Then you'll come back to me," and then Lewis left the stage, and then he screams, "Then you'll come back to me." It's not a question in the text. But now he crumbles onto the floor and says, "Please come back to me," which just by adding that please and by turning that from a scream to him offstage shows such a vulnerability in Joe that I don't think we've had before.
I mean, it wasn't until I saw the National Theatre production last year in London that I saw the inappropriateness of the relationship between Lewis and Joe. It was very easy to want to ship Lewis and Joe when it was Joe Mantello and David Marshall. Okay, I will just tell you all that. Like, I'm sorry you weren't there. I'm sorry you weren't born yet. But it really was really easy to want them to be together. And so watching this, the National Theater production particularly, it was like, oh no, from like the get-go, I was like, oh, this is so wrong for both of you, and I get why this is an ideological leather bar, and I get now, like, all of the things that were always there all along, but, you know, it took me a long time to see, past my own biases or whatever, and that creepy desperation of Joe, particularly in this production, Marianne Elliott's production, I saw it with Russell Tovey, and now Lee Pace is playing it here on Broadway, and I've not yet seen it, but, you know, it really changed the way I saw their interactions and the way in which I saw what they wanted from each other and how desperate Joe is. Like, it's not this sort of interesting new rebirth maybe that David Marshall Grant brought to it, but it's this flailing, you know, again, sort of going back to that, to the naked chaos of the way in which he's just grabbing for anything or anyone to hold on to because he's spent a life rooted by other people.
Yeah, I think we should have part two of this podcast where we talk after you have both seen Lee Pace, because he's doing some very unexpected things with Joe that I think they'll be divisive, but I thought, oh my God, Lee Pace.
I'm really excited to see his take on this character, actually. I completely agree with everything you're saying. And just this moment when Lou and Joe are about to go home together and Joe says, I don't think I deserve being loved. And Lewis says, there, see, we already have a lot in common. And he's kind of unfazed by this because he's already consumed by this other type of self-loathing. But I just thought it was interesting that Joe is thinking about this in terms of love, barely knowing this guy, barely having had any kind of interactions. And maybe Lewis isn't thinking about it in the same terms because he's had so much else going on with him. But just Joe, as you said, he's really just reaching out for anything and so desperate for affection, and is reading this pretty minor interaction as indicative of something more than it is. And that sort of sets him up for failure and pain.
It's always been there, the whole sort of Joe seeking, you know, sort of the love of his father that he never had, mm-hmm. and certainly mm-hmm. the, you know, sort of withholding love of his mother. I mean, you know, he is someone who's just, I mean, and again, maybe this is, again, my sort of sympathy for his character. He's always, you know, he's found himself, you know, okay, fine, I now know who I am. I now want to be this person, sort of flung open the doors, but doesn't have the tools to get through the door and figure out how to build a relationship. I mean, if you've spent your entire life with love withheld from you, how do you even begin to interpret what it is? And for him, I mean, this is that fumbling process to do so. And that's why I guess I find his character slightly more hopeful, in the sense of that, you know, I look at it, as he said, at the very, very early stages of a process that will continue well into the future. It's funny how insistent I am at the end of this play is that it's not the end of these characters.
Oh no.
And I get I was so infuriated. I mean, like, I love James McArdle's performance in London as Lewis. But he has a line in the book where he sort of thinks, you know, Pryor will probably die like within 6 months at the end of the play. And I'm like, fuck you. Do not say that. Do not even speak those words. Like, I cannot believe you would sentence him to death. And I got really upset, and I realized, okay, like, maybe my belief in the timeline of this play being perpetual is maybe a little irrational. But I also wanted to point out that, you know, the play is so clear on the process of the development of this work and Tony Kushner's writing of it and rewriting of it and all of that. But I was surprised by how much I learned about directing. Mm-hmm. You know, they do break the book down into these interludes of the characters. And so the actors and people speak all about each of the characters sort of individually. And that gave me just such an insight into the process of some of the directors who were involved in the play, and even the way in which the actors themselves found their way to their character in that work, which, you know, was sort of unexpected to me. Let me move on to what moved us most in this book, because I definitely cried a lot.
Yeah.
It was hard for me to, like, settle on, like, one thing. For me, I don't know. I mean, again, the David Marshall Grant stuff I definitely was very moved by. But there was a point where Ellen McLaughlin, who played the angel almost from the earliest part of the Eureka production, I mean, pretty much from the beginning through to Broadway. And she talks about a point where her massage therapist noticed that she was starting to develop wing muscles on her back. And there was just something so beautiful and poetic and metaphorical about the labor of this play physically changing her. And I mean, she had spent, you know, years and years of this character working wings on stage. And, you know, for me, this play has permanently changed my brain. I mean, it is a formative part of my life in New York, and my love of theater, and my experience of myself and just growing up and learning about myself and processing my own issues of self-loathing and shame. Ooh, yay. So, you know, so I thought that that imagery was just so wonderful. And then she further gives sort of a lovely tribute to the designer, the wing designer on Broadway, John Deary, who died of AIDS shortly after the play opened. And she says, I felt like I carried him on my back after he died, and I was always grateful for the extraordinary care he expended on the wings. They were something to behold. And there's just, I mean, she's a playwright as well as being an actor. And I mean, there was just something so beautiful in the way she speaks in this book.
I was really moved by this book from the very beginning because it starts in the height of the AIDS crisis. And it talks about how what was happening in the world spurred Tony Kushner to write this play. And is the section where they talk about where Robert Stanton talks about going to see The Normal Heart. He says, I'm sitting in the audience watching The Normal Heart, and it's like AIDS 101, and it was effective. There's the scene between the doctor and Brad Davis, and she asks what his sexual behavior with his partner is, and she basically says, all caps, what are you doing? And my blood ran cold. He talks about how later, how a doctor, or how he said to himself that he wanted to get an HIV test, but then he said, what's the point? If you have HIV, you're going to die. So isn't it better to not know? And then he says that later a doctor literally said that to him. And how this was the way we were talking about AIDS. And this was the way that people were, you know, if you're familiar with The Normal Heart, you know that The Normal Heart is a very angry, screamy, yelly play. There's spilled milk and people cry over it. And, you know, there's that famous monologue about the garbage bags in The Normal Heart. And then Angels came after that and takes that anger but transmutes it into a huge panoramic view of all of these people that are affected by AIDS and that are affected by the idea of homosexuality at the time. And I was really moved by sort of taking that and taking what was happening in the world at the time and creating art from that. Because now that AIDS is not, it's not a death sentence anymore for most people, we sort of lose that context. We sort of lose how awful it was unless you were there. And then obviously you still remember. But, you know, I know that a lot of gay men of my generation don't, you know, you get an STD and you can take some pills and it's, or it takes, you know, whatever medication and it's done. You know, you don't have it anymore. But when these people were coming from this time of such fear and they could die from having sex, it's terrifying. It was so moving to me to be reminded of that and of how this play takes that real life passion, that real life, it takes the realness of that and makes it into something so huge and poetic and life-changing.
Yeah, I mean, I marked that quote about The Normal Heart as AIDS 101 as well. Just the idea that for a lot of people, because, you know, the newspapers weren't really talking about it, people didn't necessarily know what it meant. There was kind of a deliberate silence from the administration at that time. Mm-hmm. And the idea that theater could have this impact on the national conversation and be where you learned about something that you might have, like a number of quotes in the book are about moments where Pryor's lesions are revealed and there mm-hmm. are people in the audience who are kind of like, oh, I might have that, or this could be me. And people who took their parents to see the play and then, you know, in between Millennium Approaches and Perestroika or at the end of the whole marathon, they would say, I'm gay or I'm dying of AIDS. And just for that to be the kind of focal point or jumping off point for that conversation is incredible and really upsetting, obviously. But I also felt like for the actors themselves, as you were talking about, Nicole, the extent to which these roles kind of helped them to work through their own internalized homophobia or better understand things that they themselves were dealing with. There's a really incredible quote from David Marshall Grant, who played Joe, where he says, he's talking about the conversation in the play where Joe comes out to his mother over the phone. And he says, to say that out loud every night, the thing I tried so hard not to be, the thing I was in therapy not to be, the thing I tried to hide from my agent, it was very cathartic. And just the idea that at that moment, this was something that was impossible to talk about and something that people were terrified of in themselves, and that this was kind of an outlet for that pain and fear for him, and that it helped him to come to grips with his own identity in that way, is incredibly upsetting that it was necessary, but it just really drives home the importance of this as a play to so many people who were in it and who saw it. Its impact on everything that we now are as a community and the rest of the world's understanding of that.
I think it's why it upsets me sometimes when people treat it as a historic AIDS play, as if these conversations, as if people's self-realizations, as if these journeys are somehow limited to an experience in the 1980s, that people aren't still, struggling through self-expression and struggling through making relationships for themselves or finding love or finding themselves worthy of love. And I think seeing those characters do that at any, two or three stages of my life, seeing different productions of this has been still incredibly emotional. I mean, certainly, again, it sort of takes me back to my teenage self, but I do think that this play has an important contribution to make to audiences today, to younger audiences today. I was so excited. A performance artist and teacher that I follow on Twitter took her 9-year-old and her 14-year-old to go see the show this week. And she said that, the 14-year-old loved it and was laughing. And the 9-year-old had some questions and sort of talked about sex and gender. And, she's a performance artist who does a lot with menstrual blood. So I imagine the conversations she has at her breakfast table with her kids are very different from the ones my mom had with me. And I, love her for it. And it does make me believe that this play has so much value for everyone today still. And yes, it reflects a particular piece of history, but I feel like there's so many different ways to read this text and there's so many ways to experience this play. And, I hate to see people kind of sweeping it into the dustbin of like, oh, well, it was, just a little picture of the past and that's over and everything's fine now,
Yeah, right, because it isn't. I mean, I think this play, more so than The Normal Heart, says more than just people are dying of AIDS, which I'm not diminishing what The Normal Heart says. Larry Kramer is going to hear this and is going to come after me. But
oh my God, if Larry Kramer hears this, he's going to demand his own episode.
But The Normal Heart was important because it was the first play to say any of these things. Angel in America can exist because The Normal Heart existed. It's not existed, it still exists. But Angels is concerned with more things than just the immediate acknowledgement of the AIDS crisis. How it manages to do that and then keep the AIDS crisis so prominent and so sewn into its fabric is a triumph.
And I mean, I think that historical perspective is really valuable, especially now, because we don't necessarily have that record. So many people were lost to the AIDS crisis. And, they talk about history being rewritten quite early on in this book. And I think that's true to an extent. Like, there's been this sort of rehabilitation of Reagan. Hillary Clinton commended Nancy Reagan for her, her work advocating for the victims of HIV and AIDS, which she did not do. And Roy Cohn's protege is in the White House, and Pence has his own complicated bad relationship with HIV and AIDS and conversion therapy. And,
it's... But if there's one person who needs to see this play...
Yeah, and it's painfully relevant. But I think just having it both for the specificity of this moment in history and for the universality of the themes and experiences, it does so much on so many levels. And, I don't want it to be consigned to a period piece as such. But I think it is a really valuable expression of that moment as well.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that came up in the book that I don't think a lot about, and this is my own sort of privileged, limited perspective, and you sort of touched on it a little bit with the character of Belize and the way in which sort of race plays a role in the work, is not a wildly diverse play. There is some reconsideration, Tony Kushner, and sort of in the book, perhaps this character of Belize as the nurse, as a supporting character. And maybe if I'd written the play today, I wouldn't have written it the same way.
Yeah.
I thought that Nathan Stewart Jarrett, when he talks about experiencing the Democracy in America speech, talks about how painful it is to sit there and take that shit. And I think it's easy to have watched this play over time and sort of relish the ridiculousness of Lewis and his overzealous, completely, wrong-headed political theorizing and contradictions and stupidity, overly thought, underthought stupidity. And I hadn't, again, being in my own sort of white privilege, considered what it's like to have to experience that lecture. I mean, because it is set up as a very comedic moment. We know Belize's response is coming. We anticipate a takedown of Lewis in any, you know, way, and it's going to happen. But even so, as an actor having to sit there and listen to that, there was in the book, you know, some commentary about the limited perspective of the play in that sense. And I appreciated the having that conversation now, since it is a much bigger part of the conversation now than it was then. But it does kind of lead to the question of sort of criticisms of the book, because this doesn't just have to be a love fest. This is our little book club. But I did want to make space for anyone who has complaints, such as they are. So feel free now to air your complaints. Everyone turns to their notebooks.
I already mentioned Michael Riedel, and not to give him more time, but I thought that every contribution he had was completely unnecessary to the story they were telling. And there's even that part in the book where they quote Michael Riedel, and then someone says Michael Riedel's a little shit or something like that. I mean, I would have appreciated some dissenting voices, you know, as we mentioned here, that we should have added dissenting voice as well. But also, like, you're not going to read this. You don't read this book to hear bad things about Angels in America. You know, you're not going to say, let me read this 400-page oral history to hear people who don't like the book, who don't like the play, you know? So
perspective will not be validated by this oral history.
Yeah, right. So that was my only quibble, is like I didn't think that Riedel's interjections were necessary. And they didn't add anything to the book.
Yeah.
I feel like the emptiest statement of all time is like, it's the Hamilton of fill in the blank.
Oh, yeah. Just like,
fuck off.
It just happened
forever.
So many people said that, and it just kept coming. And I was like, okay, well, maybe you can make this point once to like evoke the scale of it or whatever, but we don't need to hear that 20 times. I just, yeah, that
also
was...
Also because we hear it every day on the internet all the time. It is like, because we are still living in the moment.
Yeah, right. I was like, why can't you just say that this play was a big deal without comparing it to Hamilton? Like, why does all theater have to be held up next to Hamilton now? Yeah. It's completely absurd.
I guess my complaint, if I had one, was, I mean, maybe I would have appreciated a little bit more sort of cultural context. Mm. I mean, obviously the oral history structure, you know, is going to be driven by the artists and production experiences. And there were so many more productions in there than I kind of anticipated. Mm-hmm. You know, it was nice to hear about the national tour, which I knew nothing about, and, you know, the David Cromer's production. And, I mean, there were things in the Ivo Van Hove production that I'd forgotten that conversation sort of reminded me of. So I was kind of appreciative of the scope of... you know, sort of student productions and other productions and the voices of playwrights today who were influenced by it and all of that. But I guess I mean, there's still a piece of it that, I mean, I bring my own history of the time to it and my own sense of what was going on. But I think, as you were sort of talking about, Alex, the underwritten media conversations about some of these things and the way in which history has not necessarily been well reflected by media means that we are really dependent on books are, you know, taking the moment here to give some more perspective. And certainly there is. I mean, the culture wars, the campus culture wars of the 90s. I'm like, oh, yeah, I really would read a book on that to give myself some shape of it. Because, again, I was like, oh, I was pressed up against it in my own university, in my own experience of it, not realizing there was, you know, there was a little bit of that. There was a national conversation happening about it. But the specifics of that, you know, here specifically relating to the sort of problems with taking the tour and university productions of it, which is, again, so funny, where I was coming from a university that was like, everyone read this gay play, please. And I hadn't realized how unique my NYU experience was for that sense. You know, I mean, part of the joy of that was feeling like, oh, I'm part of this national conversation because I'm going to the school where it is part of the national conversation. And you felt, you know, that that this was part of something larger than just you sitting in this theater seat and what was happening, you know, on stage in front of you. And I feel like, again, it was an experience that spoiled me for theater in the future, because how rare is that, you know, sense that what you were experiencing resonates sort of beyond the four walls of that room and the conversation will continue, you know, out into the streets.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's to the book's credit that most of my complaints are just, I wish there was more of this. Like, it's already 400 pages long. I understand that not everything could make it in. But I do, sort of to your point, wish that they had spent a little bit more time on the politics, because I feel like it does a really good job in that first chapter of kind of grounding you in the epidemic and the kind of cultural conception and the political response or non-response in that moment. And then at the last chapter, it sort of talks about how this plays in 2018. But I felt like in the space in between, apart, they do have timelines throughout the book. So each kind of act of the book tells you the political things that were happening in that moment alongside the development of and different productions of Angels. But I felt like in the chapters themselves, that maybe wasn't as much of a focus. And I think that there would have been some value in reconstructing that a little bit more, simply because, as you say, that isn't necessarily something we have a strong grasp of or in like a bird's eye view. We get these anecdotes that are really good and illustrate those points pretty well, but you don't really get a sense of the scale of what was happening and why this mattered in the same way. And I would have liked to see more of that. But I mean, in general, I found this really effective and it taught me a lot about not just Angels, but about that time and the sort of trajectory of art and politics and culture. So, you know, on the whole, would recommend.
Thumbs up. I mean, I think if you have any interest in theater and plays, the history of plays in America, this book, you know, becomes essential. I mean, again, I am spoiled because I have seen many of the productions that are in there, you know, but I think even if you haven't, if you've only read the play, there's still so much value that comes from the voices and who's reflecting on it and their experiences, because I think it'll make you feel better about any production you've had that has gone awry.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if you know, if you feel like, oh my god, we dropped that prop and this happened, and then, trust me, nothing bad could happen as all of the things that happened to these productions of Angels.
Yeah, and I think even if you haven't seen these productions, when you read about them, it's the way that this is constructed, and because it is the voices of people who were there, you feel like you were there. I mean, I can so see the angel on that ladder in Michael Mayer's basement production or whatever it was, where the ceiling was too short. You know, it's so evocative the way these people describe their experiences with the play.
I mean, I'm just so happy it's back. I mean, you know, I haven't seen the production on Broadway yet. And I so worry that I'm like, oh my God, is this the last one I'm going to have in my lifetime on Broadway? I mean, you can appreciate a production that has all the money to throw at it,
right,
in a very different way than you know, sort of the basement productions of it that exist. And both are valid. Taking the time, the money, the energy to stage this on Broadway when it is financially challenging to stage plays on Broadway, when it is very difficult to stage two-part plays, where it's really hard to sell people on, you know, 8 hours worth of theater in anybody's busy, busy life, the audacity to try now in the particularly difficult sort of Broadway environment that exists means a lot to me, because I just think it's so critical to who we are, and it's so important to keep having this conversation and keep bringing this text back into people's lives. And I think, as you were sort of saying, like, reading it is a very different experience necessarily from seeing it, and it is a work that benefits from being seen. And so I encourage people to go and get rush tickets if the prices are too scary. Keep an eye out on TDF because it was popping up there.
The digital lottery.
You know, any which way you can, because I think there is, you know, any preconceived notions you may have about the play either will be, you know, met, changed, you know, or validated through seeing it. It's the kind of work that being in a room full of people sharing it with you, I think, becomes its own specific experience.
Yeah, and I've seen 60-minute plays that felt four times longer than both parts of this play.
Well, thank you guys for joining me here today in my living room.
Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah, thank you for giving me an excuse to talk about this play for an hour.
I'm like, can we? I just keep talking. We talk forever, but.